Good morning. And thank you, Keith, for the very warm welcome. I want to invite you to turn again to John chapter 21. Keith's read the first half of the chapter. I'm going to read the second part of the chapter. And I need to put a little disclaimer in here. There's someone, I'm not going to mention who it is, but his initials are JR, who thinks I have only got about three sermons and that I repeat myself. If you listen to me preaching this morning from John chapter 21 and you think that you've heard this before, specifically if you think you've heard me preach on this before, the answer is that you have. In July 2016, I preached here on Peter and Jesus. Well, Johnny emailed me several months ago and he said he's going to be away. And could I come and preach? And the passage would be John chapter 21. So he chose the passage. If there's a little bit of repetition, I hope you'll forgive me for that. Any of you who were here in July in 2016 have probably forgotten what I said, in which case it'll not be a bad thing for you to be reminded. And if there is a little bit of repetition, hopefully if something's worth saying once, it's worth saying more than once. So that'll be okay. But just to pick up from where Keith left off the reading and to pick up in verse 15, with this appearance of Jesus to his disciples. When they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Feed my lambs." He said to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This he said to show by what kind of death he was to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, "Follow me." Excuse me. Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them, the one who had been reclining at table close to him, and had said, "Lord, who is it that is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If it's my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So the saying spread abroad among the brothers that this disciple was not to die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he was not to die, but, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who is bearing witness about these things and who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And may God bless his word to us this morning. This chapter and the story of Jesus appearing to his disciples, to several of his disciples initially in the first half of the chapter, and then with a particular focus on his conversation with Peter, is the third of John's recorded appearances of Jesus after the resurrection. The first two you find in John chapter 20. First of all, when Jesus appears to the disciples on the first day of the week, they're meeting behind closed doors. And Jesus appears, he speaks peace to them, and he gives them his Holy Spirit. Thomas, notably, was not present at that meeting. That's put right 8 days later in the second appearance of Jesus, again with the disciples. This time Thomas is present. And that's the famous encounter where Jesus knows, is able to demonstrate that he knows what Thomas has been thinking. And Thomas believes and says, "My Lord and my God," and that's where John makes the comment, Jesus makes the comment as John records it, that "Thomas, you've believed because of what you've seen, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet who have believed." And that's a reminder to us of the purpose that John had in writing his gospel. He'd written so that people would believe. And many of the characters throughout the story of John's gospel are people who encounter Jesus in different ways. And there is that very notable encounter with Thomas. Thomas believes, and John takes the opportunity of reminding us that we, in our turn, have the opportunity not to see as Thomas did, but we, in our turn, have the opportunity to believe in Jesus. Now, the third appearance of Jesus then comes in chapter 21. And as I think I probably said when I was talking about this before a few years ago, there's something a little bit odd about John chapter 21. And the reason there's something a little bit odd about it is that when you read the end of chapter 20, to all intents and purposes, John has finished his gospel. Look back at the end of John 20. Verse 30, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And you think, well, what more would he have had to add? And various scholars and commentators have debated just exactly how John chapter 21 came to be. Did John write it? If John wrote it, did he write it at the same time that he wrote all the rest of it? Or perhaps did he write it a little later on? Some of those questions, we don't need to concern ourselves too much with some of those questions. But what I want us to focus on particularly this morning is the fact that in John chapter 21, John closes a loop for us that otherwise was left a little bit open. We know from other gospels about how Jesus had appeared to Peter. But there's still that question in the narrative of, well, how come Peter ends up in the early years of the New Testament church as a leader in the Jerusalem church? What about his denial of Jesus that's talked about just a few chapters before we get to John chapter 21, when Peter three times denies that he even knows Jesus? I mean, does that matter? Is that just forgotten? Or was there any kind of process whereby Jesus reinstates Peter and commissions him as leader? And I think that question is answered for us here in John chapter 21. And it's a picture, therefore, of the grace of Jesus, grace that's offered to people who have fallen short, people who have turned out not to be as strong or as devoted as they thought they were or as they claimed they were going to be. Now, in some ways, you can think about the story of John chapter 21 and the story of Peter in John 21 as the story of how someone who was a fisherman is transformed to become a shepherd. Now, he was a literal fisherman. That's what he's doing at the beginning of the chapter. He never becomes a literal shepherd. He doesn't exchange his fish for sheep. But the way Jesus commissions him is by calling him into this life of shepherding, not woolly sheep, but shepherding the people of God. The transformation of a fisherman who becomes a shepherd. And much of the first half of that chapter, the part that Keith read to us this morning, has to do with fish and fishing. So in the first three verses, you notice that the disciples go fishing unsuccessfully. Peter says to his friends, well, I'm going fishing. There's almost a sort of implicit invitation. Is anybody going to come with me? And several others go along with him. It's a reminder to us, I think, just in that little narrative detail, of the extent to which Peter was a leader. Someone has said, if you think you're a leader and nobody is following you, well, you're just somebody who's taking a walk. Peter wasn't like that. Peter was the kind of person that took the lead, and when he took the lead, other people followed him. You see him very often as the person who's out front of the other disciples. It's Peter who's first to come up with this answer when Jesus says, who do you say that I am? Well, you're the Christ. Peter comes up with that very quickly before anybody else. It's Peter who gets out of the boat and walks on water. It's Peter who makes this claim that all the other disciples may fall short, but I will never deny you. It's Peter who defends Jesus by attacking Malchus, the servant of the high priest, and chopping off his ear. Peter was always going out in front, and often Others were following along behind him. That's the kind of leader that Peter was. By the way, there's a reminder. Some of you are probably leader types. And there is a reminder that there's a great responsibility that rests on the shoulders of leaders. Because if you're the kind of person who says, I'm going fishing, and a bunch of people follow you, you need to be careful about how you live your life. Because if people are going to follow you, you need to make sure that you're leading them in the right direction and you're leading them to the right places. Peter leads these people fishing. And of course, that tosses up an interesting question, doesn't it? Jesus has said to the disciples in chapter 20, he said, as the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you. He says, receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of anyone, they're forgiven. If you withhold forgiveness from anyone, it is withheld. Now, at one level, it's very difficult to see how you would take that sense of commission and translate it into, well, I'm just going to go out and catch a few fish. And down through the years, some of the commentators have looked at this and said, well, what Peter and the disciples were doing was really, this was a dreadful thing. How could they just resume their old life after they'd encountered Jesus, especially after they'd encountered the risen Jesus? And maybe it's a little bit like people who have a spiritual high, some kind of spiritual experience, but in the end of the day, it makes no difference to their real lives and the trajectory of their normal lives. They have an encounter with Jesus or some sort of spiritual encounter, and when it's all finished, well, they just go back where they were before. And you maybe want to draw that kind of conclusion from this little part of the story. Other commentators are a little bit kinder to Peter. And they say, well, you know, in the end of the day, the guy had to eat. He had to eat something, and if he's going to eat something, well, he was a fisherman, and why not go out and catch some fish? So we're not quite sure how much we're meant to read into this, whether Peter was being deliberately disobedient or whether, well, it was just common sense. You had to do something in the interim period before the commission really came into play on the day of Pentecost. At any rate, they were unsuccessful until Jesus intervenes. And so in verse 4 to verse 8, the second paragraph, they now go from unsuccessfully trying to catch fish to catching fish with somewhat of a miraculous touch to this. Transformation happens when they see a stranger on the shore. They don't know who he is. Now, don't forget that there's some distance away from shore, probably at least 100 yards away from shore, or 100 meters, if you want to, more or less, if you want to convert it into metric. And also the fact that day was just breaking. And you test your own eyesight first thing in the morning when the sun's just coming up, and how well you manage to identify somebody who's maybe 100 meters away from you. They're not sure who this is, don't know who this is. But this person shouts out to them, well, try throwing your nets on the right side of the boat. And they do that, and suddenly, after fishing all night with no success, they find they've got so much fish that they hardly know what to do with it. And suddenly a light goes on, first of all in John's mind, John the disciple that Jesus loved, and he realizes that this is not just the advice of a random stranger, this is Jesus. And when he says this is the Lord, Peter, again, he's the first, remember, always the one to take the lead, jumps into the water, and off he goes to meet Jesus. Now, isn't it interesting that Jesus was able to spot what those men, experienced fishermen, didn't see? Now, at one level, maybe he's standing further back as a clearer view, but don't forget it's still not fully light yet. There's still some distance away. And perhaps the thing that triggered this for John was a little memory of something that had happened before at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and a miraculous catch of fish that's talked about in Luke chapter 5. But isn't it true that there's a vivid reminder here in this incident of what Jesus told his disciples in John chapter 15, where he said to them, in using the imagery of the vine and the branches, he said, apart from me, you can do nothing. And there's a vivid reminder of it. Before these disciples are fully launched out into the commission of taking the gospel to the ends of the earth, before that happens, one more time, there's a reminder, you can fish all night and catch nothing. But when Jesus steps in, everything changes. You know, I think we constantly need to be reminded of that. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Because sometimes we can get very clever and we can be very successful. I pastored a church in Switzerland for 17 years. It was a church of expats. It's interesting, by the way, that when you talk about a certain class of person who lives in another country, they're an expat. When you talk about a different class of person who lives in another country, they're a migrant or an immigrant. We were expats. But we had a church that was full of high achievers. We had people who worked in international organizations. We had people who worked in large businesses and had senior positions in those businesses. We had a pretty brainy bunch of people. We used to say about the people in our church that if you had 12 of them in a room, you had 13 opinions. That was the kind of thing it was. And along with the elders of the church, we used to have elders retreats. We'd do this maybe once a year. And we would have an elders retreat, and there'd usually be a flip chart or something like that. And we'd try to analyze how we were doing as a church. It was an opportunity for strategic planning. We were never short of ideas. And all these ideas would go on the flip chart, and all this vision, and all these great things. We were, you know, we were people who were pretty good at coming up with ideas. It was a strong team. And I remember one year that we were going through a bit of a leadership crisis. Don't need to go into the detail of what was happening. But we were going into a bit of a leadership crisis. We weren't really terribly sure what to do. And what happened was that we had our elders retreat around that period of time. But instead of being quick to have our flip chart out and put all of these ideas and get all of our cleverness up on a flip chart and a board and generate all of these strategic plans, instead of that, because of what we were going through, we were very humble. And we actually spent most of the time listening to what God might be saying to us. As I look back on that, it's a matter of interest. As I look back on it, the ideas that eventually came out of that time carried us for several years and turned out to be far more effective and far more fruitful, probably than all of those times when we'd done our brainstorming with our flip charts. Jesus says, apart from me, you can do nothing. Disciples fish all night, catch nothing. Jesus says, try fishing here, gentlemen. And they've so many fish, they don't know what to do with it. Very practical implications, I think, in terms of leadership. The third paragraph then has them eating fish. So trying to catch fish unsuccessfully, then they're catching more fish than they know what to do with, and then they're eating fish, a breakfast that's served by Jesus in verse 9 to verse 14. As Don Carson says in his commentary on John, I know Don Carson was here just a few weeks ago, but as he says in his commentary on John's gospel, Jesus had previously served his disciples by washing their feet. Now here he is cooking breakfast for them. When they came ashore, Jesus already had some fish. There was a barbecue, a charcoal fire. And there was some bread. And the disciples bring along 153 fish, so there's going to be plenty more to choose from. You can be sure that the fish is not going to run out. I wonder if you ever read this and wondered why there were 153 fish. Well, you'll not be surprised to know that there's been a lot of speculation about this down through the years. Some people have suggested that actually 153, at the time, that was the number of species of fish that had been identified in a river. Therefore, by talking about 153 fish and emphasizing that, John is saying, you know, this is how the gospel is going to go to everyone. It's all the fish are counted for. The only problem is that apparently when you add it up, there actually weren't 153 species of fish. There were something more than that. Another theory is an interesting one. As I was preparing for this, I was learning a little bit about triangular numbers. Now, I don't know how many of you are mathematicians here. If any of you are high-achieving mathematicians, I need to be tread a little bit cautiously. I'm certainly not a high-achieving mathematician. But here's what I've understood about triangular numbers. If you take the number 17, right, and I'll give you the significance of 17 in a moment. If you take the number 17, the triangular number of 17 is 153. Now, the way you work out a triangular number is if you take 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 all the way up to 17, you come up with 153. Another way of thinking about it is that if you have an equal-sided triangle with 17 dots down one side, 17 dots down the other side, 17 dots across the bottom of it, an equal-sided triangle, and you fill it in with equally spaced dots, you have 153 dots in there. That's a triangular number. 17 is a triangular number of 153, or the other way around, whatever it might be. Now, why 17? Well, said some of the early church thinkers, 10, think about the Bible, the Ten Commandments. 7, Book of Revelation, the sevenfold Spirit of God. It's a bit of bleak, isn't it? It's not a terribly clear as to why on earth John would want to highlight the Ten Commandments and the sevenfold Spirit. In the end of the day, probably the reason John highlights the fact there are 153 fish that were caught is because there were 153 fish, and someone counted them. You know, these were fishermen, and this was their business, and maybe, you know, if there's, I think there were 7 of them who were out fishing, so you're going to divide them all up, so you need somebody to count them. At any rate, you've got this massive number of fish, and some of them go on the barbecue, and they're having breakfast, and people are thinking, it is the Lord, but there's just that little interesting note where John says that the disciples, none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. That's a funny mix with that, isn't it? None of them dared ask because they knew it was the Lord. You think, well, if they knew it was the Lord, why would they even think about asking in the first place? And there just seems to be at this phase of these appearances of Jesus that we're pretty sure it is him, but could it really be? I mean, this seems to be too good to be true. There's that sense of confusion that's there, and very real psychology that John describes of these disciples. So here they are at the barbecue, charcoal fire, and when they've had their breakfast, Jesus says to Peter, "I need to talk to you." And Peter then Peter goes off on a walk with Jesus, and Jesus gives him an opportunity to do 3 things. First of all, he gives him the opportunity to restate his devotion to Jesus. The opportunity to restate his devotion. Jesus says, "Do you love me?" And what we need to realize is that at the heart of healthy discipleship, there is a relationship with Jesus. It's a relationship of love. Now, it actually starts with the love that Jesus has for his disciples. You read about that in John chapter 13. You've been working your way through John's gospel, and you'll have talked about that, how Jesus demonstrated his love for his disciples. But in response to the love that Jesus has for his disciples, he then asks his disciples, "Do you love me?" Now, why was it in question? Well, it was in question because of the denials. Because 3 times, Peter had denied that he knew Jesus. Now, again, there's a dilemma here. Because at one level, Peter is hugely zealous for Jesus. He's determined not to deny him. He's so zealous for Jesus that when the crowd come to arrest him, it's Peter who takes his sword and aims it at Malchus and slices off Malchus's ear. And again, this seems to suggest to me that it's possible at one minute to be really zealous and keen and eager to stand for Jesus, and yet perhaps not very long afterwards that zeal just melts away when it's under threat. 3 times Peter denies Jesus, and there's a caution for us that we're not as strong as we sometimes think we are. And isn't it fascinating that just as Peter denied Jesus beside a charcoal fire, you get that detail in the text, so here's Jesus with a charcoal fire, and the place that was the place where Peter's weakness was exposed, becomes a place where Peter finds grace and restoration. Do you love me? Do you love me more than these? You know, Peter is the one who takes the lead. He's the one who's out in front. Well, what about in terms of how much you love Jesus, Peter? Do you love me more than these other disciples love me? Are you just the leader in terms of fishing expeditions? Or are you the leader in terms of devotion? Do you love me? You know, there's so many things that you can say about the Christian life, so many things you can say about discipleship, so many aspects to it. And yet, there's a sense in which when you boil it down, a Christian is someone who loves Jesus. That's how Peter writes about it when he writes his letters later in the New Testament. You haven't seen him, but you love him. That's something that's the very heart of discipleship. And while there is so much more to discipleship, and there's so much more to being a Christian, yet it's possible, I think, that we can be so attached to so many of the other things and so preoccupied by so many of the other things that we miss the very heart of it. Now, I got a new theological insight yesterday, courtesy of my wife. She was telling me about some talks that she'd been doing yesterday at a ladies' gathering. And I hope I represent her fairly in this, but I think it illustrates the point I'm making. You think in the Old Testament about the tabernacle or the temple. Think particularly about the tabernacle and the detailed instructions that are given about constructing the tabernacle. All of the details and the measurements and the colors and so on and so on and so on. What was the tabernacle for? The tabernacle was the place where God lived among his people. What was the point of the tabernacle? It was the presence of God in the middle of his people. Now, her point was that sometimes there are those of us, and we're so keen to latch on to all, dare I say it, the legalistic details of what it means to build a tabernacle, that we lose sight that at the center of it is the presence of God. Simon Peter, you can put your own name in there. Do you love me more than these? Peter gets the chance to restate his devotion. He also gets the opportunity, secondly, to receive his commission, because Jesus says, feed my sheep. It's interesting that later on, Peter writes to elders in the church at 1 Peter chapter 5, and he talks about their responsibility as shepherds of the flock. The idea of shepherding in Scripture, there are obviously plenty of literal shepherds who looked after literal sheep, but the way the Bible talks about spiritual leadership, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, very often it talks about it in terms of shepherding. Elders are shepherds. And Peter writes to elders and he says, listen, here's how you to go about your service. He says, don't do it under compulsion, but do it willingly. Don't do it for gain. He's thinking particularly monetary gain at that particular time. Don't do it for gain, but do it because you're eager to serve. And then he says, don't do it in order to domineer, but live as an example. That's a call to humble service. Service that serves not for what it gets, but for what it gives. Now, you may or may not be called to be a spiritual leader. Doesn't matter. This, I think, is what we're all called to. To follow this example that Jesus himself gives of a servant leader who washes the feet of his disciples, who lays down his own life for his sheep, and who then says to his disciples, I've given you an example for you to follow. And he says to Peter, Peter, I want you to feed my sheep. You know, just across the street, you've I assume you've all seen it. I hope you've all seen it and paid attention to it. There's a little statue of Amy Carmichael. And if I can borrow from Amy Carmichael, I'm just going to slightly change one of the things that she said. You can serve without loving, but you cannot love without serving. And so Jesus says to Peter, Peter, do you love me? Chance to restate his devotion. And then he says, well, then feed my sheep. A chance to receive his commission. And the final thing is he gets the opportunity to renew his focus. Follow me. Jesus did not have a Facebook page or a Twitter account, so it's nothing to do with social media. Now, at one level, it could be simply a walk on the beach. Peter, we've had breakfast. Follow me. Need to talk to you. But it does appear when Jesus talks like this, he seems to be pointing to something much more. Peter has been following Jesus for 3 years, and he's going to continue to follow Jesus. Charles Spurgeon said, the main business of our life is to follow the Lord. And you realize from the narrative that there's a couple of things that could make following Jesus particularly challenging. One is the challenge of the path that Peter is going to have to walk. Jesus talks to him about what lies ahead of him. He says, you know, when you're young, well, you've got a lot of autonomy, you've got a lot of independence. You're able to go where you want to. You're able to dress yourself, walk where you wanted. But he says, when you're old, you'll stretch out your hands, another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. Jesus' point here is that Peter is going to lose his liberty. And he's not just talking about Peter losing his liberty, perhaps the way an aging process affects all of us over the course of time. But he's talking very specifically about how Peter's going to lose his liberty and he's going to be put to death. That's what lies ahead of him in following Jesus. Now, I know that there are some who think that when Jesus says this, it's a sense of reassurance. Because previously, Peter has disappeared when the pressure was on. He's denied that he knows Jesus. But in saying this, Jesus is saying, well, actually, Peter, this time you're going to follow me all the way through to the end. I'm not sure that I'm convinced by that theory. But I look at this and think, wow, that's a challenge for Peter, isn't it? It's a challenge for anybody. Peter, I want you to follow me. And I want you to know that it is not going to be easy. And you know, there may be some of us and we're a little bit put off by the idea of following Jesus because we're not sure where it's going to lead, or we think it may lead us into some very difficult places. Do you remember those tragic events of just a week ago with a dreadful atrocity, murder in Sri Lanka? And some of you probably read that in one of those churches, the Sunday school had just been meeting just in the moments before the bomb went off. And the Sunday school children were asked by their teachers, how many of you would actually be prepared to die for Christ? And the kids had said, yeah, they would. And just within a few minutes, half of them actually did die for Jesus. Not easy to follow if you know that the path ahead is challenging. But the other thing, of course, is the distraction of, well, what about these other guys? He looks around, he sees John. John's walking on the beach as well. He looks around, he sees John, and he says to Jesus, well, this is what you're calling me to follow you towards, this very difficult path. Well, what about John there? What's it going to be like for him? And we compare, don't we? And sometimes there are some of us and we're very zealous in serving, we're very zealous in working. And we look around and we see others whose path seems to be a little less challenging than ours. The challenges that they face in their discipleship seem to be less demanding. They don't seem to be as committed, not as wholeheartedly as we are. Maybe their achievements seem greater at less cost than ours, and so on and so on and so on. We can look around us and we can compare. And Jesus says to us, what is that to you? You follow me. And that's the opportunity that Peter has to renew his focus, restate his devotion. Peter, do you love me? To receive his commission, I want you to feed my sheep. And to renew his focus, follow me. Easter was a week ago. I'm sure that you still have a few pieces of chocolate egg. I hope you've still got a few pieces of chocolate egg and you haven't eaten the whole thing. The relics of Easter that are maybe in your fridge. I know some of the relics of Easter are in our fridge and dotted around our house. But Easter's pretty much over, isn't it? Tomorrow it's back to work, back to school, if you're not already back. But tomorrow, you know, Easter becomes a thing of the past. By the way, not if you're an Anglican, because last Sunday was Easter Sunday for the Anglicans, but Easter lasts for 50 days if you're an Anglican. So it's a whole season of Easter, a whole festival of Easter. But, you know, for the way that most of us think, well, that was last week. It was great to be reminded of those stories of Jesus' victory, of him rising again, appearing to the various disciples and to the women and so on and so on. Wonderful, inspiring stories. But now we're back to the norm. But before we leave those amazing stories of the risen Jesus, let me just suggest this to you. Today's going to be like a little P.S. Because in some ways, John 21 feels like a bit of a P.S. to the gospel. John comes back and says, oh, need to tell you this bit. And in that P.S., there's this challenge to discipleship. And so as I finish, this is what I would say to us. As we've celebrated Easter, some of you have had holidays and been away at the caravan or wherever, maybe somewhere exotic in the sunshine. Well, last week could have been Bangor. That was exotic in the sunshine. But just before we leave the story, P.S., discipleship challenge. And a fresh opportunity as we think about the risen Jesus. A fresh opportunity to restate our devotion. To receive our commission. And to renew our focus, set out to follow him. May God bless his word to us.